So this morning, I'd like to talk in a little more detail, with a little more specificity than I did in a talk I gave on Buddha's Enlightenment Day about the four immeasurables. So this is kind of part two, but kind of not. according to Buddhist mythology, when Buddha had his experience of letting go of all of his worries and fears and his separate self and feeling joined to all life, he was asked what that experience was like, and he said, it can't be measured. It can't be measured. I can't tell you. But then in later teaching, he talked about four immeasurables, four components of that experience, four manifestations of that openness that could actually be cultivated and could evoke that openness to all of life, where we're not cut off and isolated. Okay? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? So, equanimity, loving kindness, boundless joy, and compassion, the four immeasurables. And I'll talk about each of them a little bit and give some examples. And then I'll talk about their enemies in Buddhist teaching, their enemies. equanimity. Start with a story from supposedly Buddha's life. An outsider stopped in on Buddha's camp. They lived outdoors. It's India. It's not the monsoon, so they can live outdoors. And the outsider stopped in because he wanted to stop his mind road. Stop the mind road that's cruising all over the place. That's going in all directions. It's having lots of crashes. And sometimes not having any crashes, but just freaking out, avoiding crashes, because there are so many thoughts going in so many different directions. So the outsider wanted to stop the mind road that was always taking him off in different directions. And he said this to Buddha, and Buddha sat still. And he motioned to the outsider to sit still next to Buddha. So the outsider sat still next to Buddha. Doesn't say how long he sat still, but he did experience a deep calmness like nothing he had never experienced before. And he said afterwards, "This opened the clouds of delusion and enabled me to sink into immeasurable equanimity, immeasurable stillness, immeasurable calmness." And the insider was there too in this story. The insider is Ananda. Ananda is Buddha's attendant who helps Buddha, remembers everything that Buddha learned, everything that Buddha taught, so he can then share it with others. Takes care of, makes sure Buddha has a glass of water when Buddha's teaching, because Buddha gets, in India, you know, Buddha needs lots of water. takes care of Buddha, his attendant, his helper, his facilitator. So the insider, Ananda, watched this whole thing, but didn't experience the equanimity himself. And of course, the teaching is here, although this is just, the teaching is that the insider, Ananda, is used to Buddha. He's used to him. He's used to his moods. He's used to his manner of speaking. He's used to his being quiet when everybody asks questions and people thinking it's profound. He's used to that. He's on to Buddha. In a way, he's too familiar. He's become too familiar. So that his relationship with Buddha and with the little Sangha is gotten kind of stale, because it's, you know, he's got it down. He knows the moves. He's got the, he's, you know, he knows what's going to happen next. So that's interesting, isn't it? That's interesting. So he's not able to rest in the fresh reservoir of stillness that's not measurable, because through his measuring faculties, he's got a whole world. So he's not able to break out of it. So we can say that it's more comfortable to be an insider. I am really an insider here at MZMC. I'm the insidest insider, I guess. It's really comfortable in a way. But in terms of being present to whatever is going on, alert, awake, and alive, maybe it's better to be more of an outsider. Maybe so. But don't turn it into something you try to do. then you're moving toward the inside. So I was thinking about this. I've thought about this a lot, actually. Is there a better chance of experiencing a deep calmness, a deep joy, a loving kindness, a compassion that cannot be measured if we're insiders or outsiders? Well, let's not get too hung on this, but I want to tell one more story from my own life, which some of you I've told already. But before that, here's Ananda saying to Buddha, "What did the outsider realize to make him praise you?" And Buddha says, "He realized boundlessness, that which cannot be touched by the measuring mind." Not be touched by the measuring mind. So the measuring mind is fixed on getting something, on fitting in, on trying to be good. And so it often overlooks just this calmness that's right here. Just right here. It isn't even deep. It's just right here. It doesn't know it's deep, doesn't know it's calm, but it's right here. Right here. Always. Always. So, after Buddha's death, Ananda finally experienced that calmness. But that's a different story. That's a different story. Another story that I want to share about equanimity, about calmness, is a story about my own first teacher. So my own first teacher, Suzuki, used to be driven down by one of his students to my hometown from San Francisco to Palo Alto to lead a weekly sitting group. That was okay at 5 a.m. in the morning, but then they drove back from Palo Alto to San Francisco during rush hour. It would take them about 25 minutes in the morning going down and about an hour to an hour and a half going up. Those of you who have been going to St. Paul from Minneapolis over the years, you know what I mean, or back and forth. Yeah. And a lot of cars honking. In those days, a lot of open windows, people shouting, fumes. So my teacher didn't drive, and Phil drove. So Phil just brought him down every week to my hometown. I said, "Well, how was that driving down?" He said, "It was really nice. Oh, really nice." I said, "Oh, all that congestion." And he said, "Oh, nice." And I asked him a second time, and he said, "Well, I tried to tell Sensei my dream. I had a really important deep dream on the way up to San Francisco from Palo Alto, and he fell asleep." And I said, "Oh, was that unusual?" And he said, "No, he usually fell asleep." And he said he fell asleep right in the middle of the traffic. And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have classes in the morning. Maybe I should drive him." He said, no, I like it. It's good practice for me. It's good practice." I don't think Suzuki was teaching him anything in particular, although he did say that. We always have, you know, people are always saying that. I don't think, sometimes the teachers do try to teach things, but more often than not, it's life that's teaching us. The teacher's falling asleep. Life's teaching him about equanimity, about just being calm, about being just where he is. That's what life's teaching him. He was a still sitter, Phil was, a quiet sitter, Zazen sitter. But these were the trips that taught him about equanimity, not so much being on the cushion. And so it's a good practice, this practice of equanimity, on the cushion and off the cushion. And sometimes it stills our prejudices and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it stills our judgments and sometimes it doesn't. There are always going to be ups and downs. And if we can just be with them, it's no big deal. It's just no big deal. And we develop some steadiness. Whether it's a traffic jam or an earthquake or something bad that's happened to us or our friends, we develop some steadiness in just being able to be with it. Just be with it. So my last example of equanimity is also my teacher, my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. So he was teaching us about the precepts in Buddhism, the precepts, the norms for behavior, the norms for ethical behavior, which are very important, very important. And the night before this, I had this experience with him. He'd been teaching us the fifth precept. I think it's the fifth precept. I didn't write it down, but I think it is. Do not intoxicate the mind of self or others. And we'll be teaching that. We're initiating some folks in the Dharma during the next few months, and we'll be teaching that precept. Do not intoxicate the mind or self of others. And that's an important one. That's an important one. So he had been teaching that in the evening. Then in the morning, I was driving someplace with him, somewhere around San Francisco, and I was in a car. I was not driving the car, and this is so many years ago. I'm not exactly sure. I'm not exactly sure about any of this stuff. You know, as I tell the stories, I get sure and sure. But beware, beware. Right? That's how mythology develops. You become sure and sure. Now, does it become mythology or fundamentalism? Well, hopefully mythology, not fundamentalism. So anyway, driving in this car, And this is like, you know, this is the middle of the 60s. This is San Francisco in the middle of the 60s, right? Middle to late 60s. So that car that he and I are riding in reeks of marijuana. It reeks of marijuana. And there's some very, what would you say, abrasive music playing on the radio. Even for me in the 60s. I don't remember what it was, but I remember the odor. You could get kind of got high by breathing just in the car, if you know what I mean. Maybe you don't. Most of you probably do. And so Suzuki was not dumb. I mean, he was not dumb. And so he said, I am not for or against marijuana. I'm just trying to show people our way. And then we drove on. He was equanimous. He was calm. He was just present. He made a statement. He made an important statement, but he made it from gentleness, from calmness, rather than freaking out. Oh, they violated the precept. Bad. I want to get out of this car. No, just there. I'm trying to show people our way. Our way. Equanimous way is not before or against something. It's just with it. Just with it. That's why it's equanimous. That's why it's calm. Because it's not pushing and pulling so much. Hardly pushing and pulling at all. So I didn't meet my first teacher until he was 60 years old, I think. I added it up, tried adding it up. I think it was 6 years old. And he'd been practicing meditation for a long, long time. And if you read his book, Crooked Cucumber, his biography, Crooked Cucumber, Susan and Nelson and I were just talking about this a while ago. If you read his biography, you'll see that as a younger man, he was not very equanimous. He had a huge, really bad temper. And there were some things that were not so cool about how he lived and about how he treated his family members. And he got to San Francisco at 55 years old. And what he said to us was, the most wonderful thing about coming to San Francisco is that I finally got to do all the zazen I wanted. I didn't have to run a temple. I didn't have to worry about all these rituals that I had to do for the parishioners. And all these people just wanted to sit with me. So he did meditation twice a day, and he led all these retreats. So by the time I met him, he'd been doing that for 5 years. And he was a mellow fellow. A mellow fellow. So anyway, this equanimity is our in a way our birthright. We can all do this. It's a practice. It's a practice. And Paul, I'm going to need you to put the clock out so I can see it. And the next one that I want to talk about is loving kindness. Loving kindness. So in a way, Phil, if you read Crooked Cucumber, you'll see Phil in there. Phil Wilson was his name. I hope he's still alive. He's about 3 or 4 years older than me. So Phil Wilson, in a way, he was my first mentor on the path of Buddhist practice, of Zen practice. We had no mentors in those days. We had no one-to-ones with a teacher. We had no coffee hour. Let's see, we had no initiation. we didn't have anything. We just come and go in the quiet. And once in a while, somebody would offer to give you a ride in their car that reeked of marijuana. But other than that, we had no internal support. Now we could go meet. I finally found out you could go meet with Sensei, with Suzuki, but nobody ever told me that or suggested that. I just found out I could do it. So Phil was in a way my first mentor when I was really struggling. You know, loving kindness. He just reached out to me. I don't know, maybe I looked like I was in bad shape. I guess I was in bad shape. He just had affection for me and supported me in my wobbly sitting and my attempt to get a sitting practice going without ever giving me advice. Loving kindness and giving advice don't usually mix very well together. You think advice is 90% of the time your advice is not embedded in deep loving kindness, and people don't experience it as loving kindness. Once in a while, but it should come out of real loving kindness. He didn't give me much advice, which was wonderful. Just warmth, just encouragement about my body, which was stiff. And my wife was saying to me the other day, she said, "Well, your body has always been stiff." Well, thanks, Linda. Then I thought, oh, I better start doing more yoga. Because she can, well, anyway, we won't get into that. So loving kindness, loving kindness comes out as great warmth. That's what I experienced with Phil. So I kept coming back. Now I kept coming back because of this teacher too. But this teacher was way up there for me, and Phil was just right here. He'd gone to the same college as me. He acted like I was a VIP. You know, I didn't know. It was just me. You know. And he didn't seem to have any motivation in particular, any agenda. He didn't seem to care if I was naughty or nice. just there for me. I was naughty sometimes. We're all naughty. He's just there for me. That's what we want, isn't it? Isn't that what we want in life? Someone just to be there for us? We don't really. It's pretty simple, isn't it? Pretty simple, this loving kindness stuff. So often, however, when we receive a genuine exchange of caring, like from someone like Phil, or anybody, we shut down because we're embarrassed or self-conscious, or we think maybe there are strings attached, that we're going to have to reciprocate, or there's some expectation, or maybe we too feel too vulnerable to take it in and acknowledge it as a gift. Or maybe we think we're not worthy of it. But Phil did it in a way that made me feel worthy. Wow, worthy. So that's the second one, loving kindness. The third, immeasurable. And again, these are called immeasurables because they are components of this manifestations of our enlightened nature, our Buddha nature. The third one is boundless joy. Boundless joy. So when I had been practicing here in Minneapolis for a few years with my second teacher, Katagiri Roshi, here, we had a teacher come from the East Coast named Robert Thurman. Raise your hand if you know who Robert Thurman is. Okay, well, Robert Thurman was a big deal. Maybe he still is a big deal. He became a bigger deal when Uma Thurman, his daughter, became a Hollywood star. In Buddhist circles, he was already a big deal, but then he became a much bigger deal. So, Robert, but in those days, Uma was just a kid, I think. I don't remember. She must have been just a kid. He came to talk to us about the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra, which he translated and wrote a large commentary on, and he worked with the Dalai Lama a lot. He's a cool guy. Anyway, he came here, stayed at my house, and then the next year or the year after, invited Katagiri Roshi out to Massachusetts to do a summer kind of teaching, maybe for, I can't remember, about 5 days in his center for whatever it was, meditative spirituality with a Buddhist meditative spirituality, which he had at some place in Massachusetts. He taught at Amherst in those days. Then I think later he moved to Columbia, and I think he may still be at Columbia. So Katagiri Roshi asked me to come with him as his attendant, although he didn't say that. I kept thinking, man, I'm supposed to be his attendant, but he's not telling me what to do, and I don't think I'm not good at that. Because, you know, when you're attendant here at Zen Center, there's something specific you do. So you get you can wrap your mind around that, and you follow the map. But when you're just hanging out with somebody, then you have to really pay attention. You have to be a good outsider. But I was a bad outsider. But I still, bad outsiders are okay if you try your best. You know, it doesn't matter. Bad, good. So anyway, he gave his talks and let his meditation out there, and I was deeply moved. I was amazed at how wonderful his teaching was. And see, I've been sitting here with him for years. I was ordained as a priest with him, by him, one of the first two, me and Norm Randolph, and sat with him a lot. And I had become an insider. So I had to go to Massachusetts to really appreciate him. Because here, I had a certain expectation. I could predict his behavior. And then I saw him in board meetings. I saw him in many, many contexts. And I lost my beginner's mind. I lost my freshness. But out there, I thought, wow, this is the same guy? And someone else who was with me said, oh, yeah, this is teaching is the same he's giving back in Minnesota. I said, but his affect and people's affect. They said, Tim, you're missing it. It's the same. Duh. So we become habituated. We become habituated. And any opportunity we can have to dehabituate ourselves is a wonderful teaching, don't you think? Wonderful. So intimacy is important in Zen. Dogen talks about intimacy. But intimacy that's based on habit, where we're so close to someone that we forget how to appreciate them because we know their next move and remember their last move, that's not intimacy. That's the opposite from intimacy. So I had to become an outsider, see him with fresh eyes, and experience a deep joy that everybody seemed to experience. And I was experiencing it too. So maybe it's better not to get too accustomed to someone or something. Or maybe it's better not to be too much. And when you think about it, since everything's changing, what we're accustomed to is our memory. Because everything's changing. Everything is always fresh. Everything's always fresh, but we get accustomed to our memory and projecting our memory into the future. That's what we get accustomed to. We get thrown into a different environment, and then there's a chance, maybe, to let go of those manacles of the mind, those blinders of the eyes. And, of course, that's what Zazen is about. That's what Zazen is about. But Zazen can become habituated too. So on the way home on the plane with Katagiri Roshi, I said to him, I noticed how it wasn't just me, but other people were really, really into what he was saying. And I said, boy, people thought really, really appreciated your Dharma teaching. That was wonderful. I said, I bet you wish you could have stayed. And he said to me, he sighed and he said, oh, they would have just gotten used to me too. We get used to people. We lose our beginner's mind. We always have a chance, though, to refresh ourselves. To refresh ourselves. Always have a chance. Always. So I came back with him, and I tried. But after a few months, I settled back into my critical way of thinking. Well, I was pretty critical of him. Pretty critical. And I regret that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Hojo-san, that I wasn't more supportive and attentive. But even in that sadness, I can come back to equanimity. Can I? Can't we? We don't have to beat ourselves up. We just come back to stillness. Just stillness. Just apologize and come back to stillness. Stillness is not far off. It's not even this far off. Just covered by habit and worrying and fearing and comparing and contrasting and upping and downing. Inning and outing, and intoxicating and TVing, right? So, my wife said on the way over, she said, have a good time. And sometimes when I come home, I say, I had a good time. And sometimes, when she asks me, sometimes I say, I didn't have a good time. But boundless joy is there at the center. There at the deepest level. That's what Katagiri communicated. Was always, not always communicating, but very often communicating. We were just missing it. Because it's here. When we rest in equanimity, there's boundless joy. It just radiates. It just radiates. It's the main affective component of our Buddha nature, our true nature. And in Sanskrit, the word is ananda, after Buddha named Ananda after that, with some hope for Ananda, when Ananda later in his life did realize boundless joy. And then the other Sanskrit word is sukha, S-U-K-K-H-A. And that's like dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A. Only dukkha is suffering, and sukha is boundless joy. So we pass right through suffering, right through with equanimity. That's where we discover boundless joy. It's just here. It's just here. You don't have to go looking for it. Just go right into the eye of the needle of your suffering, of his suffering, of her suffering, with equanimity, boundless joy. Wow. Wow. And the fourth immeasurable is compassion. And in this way, this is taught, loving kindness has to come first before compassion. Because with compassion, there has to be a willingness to experience the suffering of others. And compassion has nothing to do with sentimentality, nothing to do with politeness, nothing to do with being nice, although it doesn't hurt to be nice. It's being present with someone in their pain. With someone in their pain. Regardless of how severe it is. Just being present. Just being there with them. And of course, the practice of compassion is a little more uncomfortable than the practice of loving kindness. A little more uncomfortable. Well, yes. Yes. Because if we're really going to be compassionate with someone who's hurting, or some human being or other kind of being, we need to experience that excruciating suffering. Let it experience that. What means our own fear, our own feeling for our own sense of powerlessness needs to be secondary. We need to just open our hearts beyond that. Beyond that. Then we can hear others' cries. We can hear others' cries and respond to them with open-heartedness and empathy, but not the empathy that you practice. You know, it comes out of this practice. It comes out of the practice of equanimity. It comes out of the practice of loving kindness. It comes out of that. So, two examples. I think two. Well, it looks like three examples. Three examples. First one, I haven't read for a few years, from Tolstoy's Master and Man. The landowner, Vasily Brekhnevov, something like that, leaves his servant Nikita in the snow to die. Then he has a change of heart and rushes back. He covers Nikita with the warmth of his own body and brings him back to life. But Vasily himself dies in the process. And here's Tolstoy. Yes, he awoke, but awoke a very different man to what he had been when he fell asleep. He tried to rise and could not. He tried to move his hand and could not. He tried to move his leg and could not. He tried to turn his head, but that also he could not do. Nikita was lying behind him, beneath him, and Nikita was growing warm and was coming back to life. It seemed to him that he was Nikita and Nikita he, and that his life was no longer within himself but within Nikita. He strained his ears till he caught the sound of breathing. Yes, the faint, deep breathing of Nikita. Nikita is alive, he cried to himself in triumph, and therefore so am I. Well, that guy Tolstoy, he was onto something. Something beautiful, something wonderful, something wonderful. So Another story about my first teacher, which I did tell during Rahatsu, but most of you were not here. Those of you who were could just enjoy it again. So one of the people who sat with me in the old days was a woman named Trudy Dixon, and she was the editor of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And she was a little older than me, and I knew her pretty well. My wife and I used to babysit for her children, and she got cancer. And it was apparent that she was really hurting from her cancer. And she was a regular sitter at the San Francisco Zen Center. But actually, rather than sitting less when she got her cancer, she began sitting more. And in those days, there were no chairs. Nobody would ever sit in a chair. We didn't even sit in seiza, because the Japanese said, seiza is only for meals. And we sat full lotus or half lotus or close to half lotus, quarter lotus we could get away with. And so, you know, that was the way Japanese Zen was taught to us. Luckily, I had a young body then, or I would have gotten kicked out. Even Phil wouldn't have been able to save me. but one day, what showed up in the Zendo? A chair. I saw Suzuki Roshi bring a chair into the Zendo. And then Trudy came in. She just walked slowly in and before Zazen started, and she sat in her chair. And she was in pain. And so then every morning she sat with us. We were all in our posture, in our good or not so good posture. And she was there in a chair sitting with us. Then after I don't know how long, all of a sudden the chair, which was straight backed, turned into a real comfy chair. I saw him pulling the straight backed chair out and putting a real comfy chair in there. And she sat like where Ted is. He had her right next to him. So she was sitting right there in her comfy chair. And of course, how could I? I was really touched. I was really touched. And her cancer progressed, and in my mind, although this didn't happen, he kept adding layers of comfort to her chair. so it was just a beautiful example to me of compassion. Compassion. So finally, I think it's important with all of these to especially with the loving kindness and the compassion, to include ourselves. Include ourselves. We need to be compassionate toward ourselves too. And not just as an afterthought. When we had Hurricane Katrina, I think you guys remember that. We had Hurricane Katrina, and there was all this stuff on television, all this stuff on the radio, all this stuff in the newspapers about Hurricane Katrina. I was having some problems with some of my people I work with at work. I was trying to be compassionate, doing my best to be compassionate, but being compassionate is not easy. Suffering with someone is not easy to maintain your equanimity. And I was also having some problems with people here. And so I didn't want to hear about Hurricane Katrina. I said, Linda, please, don't turn on the radio when Hurricane Katrina's on. I said, I need to take care of myself. She said, oh, yes, I completely get it. So we can get compassion burnout if we don't take care of ourselves. So don't try too hard to be a bodhisattva. If you want to try hard to be a bodhisattva, maybe even make yourself first. Well, maybe you shouldn't make yourself first. Give yourself equal worth to the other person. No first, just give yourself equal worth. Very, very important, I think. Especially in the Zen that we learned when we were younger, there was a tendency for us to burn ourselves out. So now I want to talk a little bit. I see my time's almost up. about the enemies of the four immeasurables. But the far enemies are obvious, right? The enemy of far enemy of equanimity is agitation. Agitation, right? The far enemy of loving kindness is hatred. The far enemy of deep joy, boundless joy, is deep, boundless despair, where our despair just spills over everything. And we feel hopeless. Hopeless. And the far enemy of compassion is indifference. Indifference. But what about the near enemies? I'll just talk a little bit about those. The near enemy of equanimity. Numbing out is one near enemy of equanimity. Numbing out. When we numb out, we look equanimous. People think we're equanimous unless they're onto us. It doesn't matter what we numb out with, television or drugs or whatever it is. Or maybe just, you know, just being a vegging. Well, that's a near enemy of equanimity. And, you know, people can do that in their zazen, too. zazen is not a cure-all. Not a cure-all. We bring all this stuff, all these issues, right under the cushion. So we can notice them. We can notice them. The second near enemy of equanimity is, well, this is the same one. We engage in a juicy fantasy. We seem so equanimous. But we're just tripping out, you know, so calm. I want to sit next to Paul. He's so calm, he never moves. But then Paul actually tells me what he's been thinking about and dokes on. I think, God, is that the same Paul? But Paul doesn't really want to confess to me about it. Because it's so wild. It's embarrassing. So that near enemies of equanimity, near enemy of loving kindness, naivete, naive kindness. Buddhist teacher said, think of all beings as Buddha, but keep your hand on your wallet. Okay, I got my, keep my hand on my iPhone. My iPhone serves as my wallet. I've moved into the 21st century. Second near enemy of loving kindness, expectation attached to that kind of loving kindness. The expectation which contaminates that kindness because we want something back. We want something back. So when we experience these near enemies, we just return to our meditation, the birthplace of our equanimity, or return to whatever we're doing, just being with it, not trying to judge, until the warmth can blossom out again into loving kindness. And that creates a context for boundless joy and compassion. So the near enemy of boundless joy is a joy that we cling to. We cling to. this is a little subtle, and I don't know exactly what to say about it, except that we get a taste of joy, a sense of joy, with some great teacher like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or Katagiri Roshi, and then we want to follow them around, soak it up, go to Massachusetts with them. Why did Tim get to go to Massachusetts with them? We all want to go. We all want to go. Amachi is on my altar. People follow her around the world wanting to soak up her joy. It's okay to a degree, but we become so hungry ghost-like, and that joy is within us. It's within us. So those are just catalysts for our own immeasurable joy. So we need to be careful about that. Become dependent on the other. Supposedly, that's why Buddha decided it was time to leave his body. I mean, that's just one story, right? He said it was time to die because people were looking to the Dharma to him to give him all the feeling of openness and equanimity and loving kindness from the Dharma. And he said, look to yourselves. Look to yourself. And the near enemy of compassion, two near enemies of compassion. One is superficial compassion. That means our actions aren't coming from equanimity and loving kindness. That means there's self-involvement, there are control issues. We're left feeling helpless and exhausted. We're hooked in. We're hooked in by the person's suffering. And the second, the last one is pity. Pity. Now, sometimes it says sympathy and sometimes it says pity. I don't know. But anyway, pity. Oh, poor you. Poor you. You can't sit like me. You've been sitting with me for a long time, but you're still missing out. Poor you. I'm gonna make you my Dharma heir anyway, maybe. I think so. But poor you. Because I'm so kind to you, I'm going to make you my Dharma heir anyway.
Thank you.
So we feel sorry for someone. We feel sorry for someone. We feel superior. We're not with them. We're not with them. There's no boundless joy. There's no sense of real intimacy. With compassion, we feel exactly close. Exactly close. So when Trudy Dixon died, they had a big Japanese funeral. I'm sure it wasn't Japanese. It's just a Buddhist funeral, but to me it was all, I thought, oh, this is all Japanese. But it was a funeral with a lot of ritual, and Suzuki had some kind of a hat on. I don't know. Maybe that's my imagination. Maybe some kind of a hat on. And, you know, lots of chanting and lots of stuff. And he didn't say anything, but then it was the very end, and he raised his stick or something, and he said, from his hara, you know, that's the deep belly, he said, "Go, my disciple." And I saw tears coming down his cheeks. Tears going down his cheeks. So, and I was again very moved. I'm very moved. So those are the four immeasurables. And we have a little bit of time to have questions, comments, or whatever. Yeah.
Maybe you address this toward the end after the compassion piece and kind of setting yourself as equal. But I understand the concept of, you know, wanting to turn off this kind of nebulous, impersonal, outside suffering, something like Katrina. You know, I don't watch CNN for that reason, because it's too much sometimes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I have people in my life
uh-huh.
that have, they have suffered.
Yeah.
They have taken that suffering, and they've held on to it, and they've made it part of their identity.
Yes.
And so by spending time with them,
yes.
it feels like some self-inflicted form of punishment.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
but at the same time, you know, when that suffering becomes so personal and so endless and so perpetual and something that you have a limited well
yes.
of empathy for,
yes.
How do you protect yourself?
Yes. Uh-huh. 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 That's a good question, don't you think? Does anybody have the answer? I'm hoping to get the answer. I think we need to pay attention. And some people just are in, they're in continual, perpetual hungry ghost states. And I won't talk about it. They're in perpetual states where they're just needy, 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 not okay, going over the same old things over and over again, and we love them. We love them. So what is compassion? I would say that at some point, compassion is, they want us to give so much to them often that we'll be in the same trough they are. So we have to notice that and not go into their trough. Now, can we be with them and still not go into their trough? I think so. But it doesn't mean indulging their angst. It means maybe sitting quietly with them and not saying much of anything, or even changing the subject. Sometimes that's a compassionate thing to do. Bring them back to having a cup of tea with you, as my teacher used to do with me, or having some bread with you, or some brownie or something. So their compassion should be skillful. It shouldn't be. And sometimes you have to be. Use your thinking mind about how to deal with this. Or you all get in the same trough, and that becomes codependent then, in what's called idiot compassion. The Tibetans use that term. I don't know if it's a very cool term. I wouldn't use that term. Not me. Too judgmental. I'm not judgmental. Does that make sense? Maybe time for one more.
Oh,
Paul.
You mentioned one point about meditation and how that can get habitual.
Yep.
Stale. How can you tell when you're kind of slipping into that through some warning signs that, I should shake it up and what?
Yeah, well, when your meditation gets stale, there are different things you can do, but you want to get yourself out of that rut. So you can talk with me, or talk with one of the other teachers, or talk with a friend. You can notice if the time you sit is not working because you're anxious at that time, and maybe there's another time of day you should be sitting. You can vary. If you're doing bare awareness, you can come use a little mantra, a little gata that you chant to yourself. If you're using breathing, you can vary your meditation approach. Vary it. I mean, the tools for meditation in Buddhism are, the toolbox is huge. It's a huge toolbox. So find another tool and don't just, I'm a good boy because I'm showing up at 3:34 or something.
Yeah, yeah. If you could run into getting to that state and not really realizing it.
Well, yeah, if you don't realizing it, maybe your friend will realize it, or your spouse, or maybe your teacher or somebody. Say, look, this doesn't seem to be, you seem to be as cranky as you ever were. Oh, me? Moi? Good. All right, thank you.